One of the largest collections of art looted by the Nazis in the 1930s and 40s has turned up in a dingy apartment in Munich. The trove of 1,500 artworks includes paintings by Matisse, Picasso, Dix, and Chagall, many of which are believed to have been seized from museums and Jewish collectors, and it has been valued at nearly $1.35 billion. Now, it's also been revealed that the U.S. military may have inspected part of the collection after World War II and then returned it to a Nazi art dealer named Hildebrand Gurlitt. We are joined now by Christoph Zuschlag, a professor of art history at the University of Koblenz in Landau, Germany, and by David Lewis, the co-chair of the Commission for Looted Art in Europe. And I'm very pleased to welcome both of them to our show. Hello.
Hello.
Christoph, wasn't this collection rediscovered in 2012? Why has it taken so long for word about it to leak out?
Well, it really is a very, very long story, which starts on September 22nd, 2010, when Hildebrand Gurlitt's son, Cornelis Gurlitt, traveled from Germany to Switzerland and back to Germany on the same day. And custom officers discovered a high amount of cash in his baggage. So then they started to observe this man, Cornelis Gurlitt, and only on February 28, 2012, they made a house search, and they discovered the artworks and confiscated them because they believed it was stolen art. So
and the money had come from pieces that he was selling?
Yeah. That's what they assumed. So he obviously, in the last years, he obviously lived from selling artworks in his collection. That's right. So the officials in Germany know about it since February 2012.
And they have not talked about it for over a year?
This is correct because they argue, the federal prosecutors argue, that that it's a pending story. They still investigating the case, so they didn't want to inform the public before they really knew what's going on.
David, how does the size and scope of this find compare to other collections of looted art that you've seen over the years?
This is very substantial. I mean, one does not normally come across such a number in one location. So it's quite exceptional. That is why it's causing such a stir.
And aren't some of the artworks previously unknown?
Well, any question of that kind is very difficult to answer until such time as the German authorities become fully transparent and publish, with photographs, etc., a complete list of the works. Until then, one is only guessing at a small part of it, some which, as you mentioned in your introduction, were identified by the American Army after the war, and just a few that were briefly shown at the press conference earlier this week. But, I mean, these are a minor number compared with the total, so nobody knows. We're waiting for full disclosure.
Christoph, what do you make of how the German government has handled this find?
Can you repeat it, please?
What do you make of how the German government has handled this find? Because the authorities have ruled out publishing pictures of the artwork on the internet or putting them on display, and that's why, as David points out,
yeah,
we don't know what is really in this collection.
It's exactly like David said it. It's in the last press conference on Tuesday, they only presented 11 artworks with pictures and names of the artists and titles, techniques, and some keywords for the history of the artworks. 11 artworks out of a total of 1,400. So this really is the problem, that we only have a very, very few information about this case. And once again, the official opinion is that they want to find out really what the history of the artworks is before they publish it. And of course, as an art historian, I would argue they should put everything on the internet with photographs and everything. But they say it's still an illegal act.
Now, David, these 11 works, do they cover a range of art? Are they both old masters and contemporary works?
No, they seem to be they're mainly early 20th century works, it appears probable from what we know that the majority of the works are 19th century and 20th century, but that's only what has been revealed from the American list and these, as Christoph says, this minor amount of 11 works. We really don't know. What it seems is that the majority are 19th and 20th century, some old masters, but we are really short of proper information.
And we don't know where most of them came from and who they may have belonged to, although I have read that many were taken from France.
Well, indeed. I mean, the information that we have to date is taken from the American interviews with the father, Hildebrand Gurlitt, in 1945, when he was interrogated. This is publicly available. It's on the your National Archive. We have a copy here, and in English translation, I may say, which gives his story and lists of works of art that he then claimed were his. And
before his son started selling off some of them.
This is the father.
Yeah.
We don't know, because this is only about 130, 140 items in those lists. So we really have very, very limited information. I mean, the lists in the American interrogation were 117 paintings. I'm reading from a summary here, 19 drawings and 72 decorative objects. Now, you know, that's not very many. 11 of which were fleetingly shown at the press conference. This is not the way to handle this. If they want to investigate the history of all these items, rightly, they should publicize them. So the art world, academic, scholars, art dealers, the auction houses, organizations such as ourselves who have major databases and historic records have an opportunity to investigate with them. They should be welcoming such full disclosure.
Now, Christoph, have you read those transcripts as well?
No, I don't have the source. I've heard about it, but I don't have it.
So let me ask David, how did Mr. Gurlitt defend himself?
Well, he was interviewed by First Lieutenant Dwight McKay, in Aschbach in Germany in June 45. I have it in front of me. He starts off with his history of when he was born, his mother, his father, and so forth. And then what he did, he said he was an art dealer. He was before he was in Hamburg as director of the museum there. His very first words in the questioning, how did it happen? I bought paintings in France to Dr. Voss, the commissioner for the Führer's Museum in Linz. This was Hitler's proposed museum in Linz. And Gurlitz was the man in, you know, finding the paintings. His first words are, I was an anti-Nazi. Well, you can believe that if you want.
But he was part Jewish, wasn't he?
How
did he come to work for
one,
the Nazis?
One quarter Jewish.
Well, that was enough to get you sent to a concentration camp.
It could be, but if you worked for the Nazis and you were important enough to them, you would be let off the hook. And that's what he and many others did. By throwing in his lot with the Nazis, they were willing to ignore, in this case, a 25% Jewish bloodline. And he threw in his lot. And we have pages of this, and he goes on to say that he was working with a Dr. Voss, V-O-S-S, who was his immediate superior. His ultimate superior was Bormann. He actually says it here.
Martin Bormann.
Yeah, well, I presume, yeah, Reichsleiter Bormann, must be Martin Bormann. The superior authority was, as far as I know, I'm reading it, the office of Reichsleiter Bormann. And he talks about, I mean, I'm doing this very briefly, he refers to Lohse, that's L-O-H-S-E, he was a notorious Gestapo man with collections in bank vaults in Switzerland to this day. He talks about buying all sorts of things in Paris in 1942 and 1943. I mean, you know, it beggars belief that this would be, that he would assume this was all perfectly reasonable things in a normal art market. This was occupied France in the middle of the war, concentration camps all around them and all the rest of it. And this was his story. And, at the end of the day, Lieutenant McKay decided, okay, it's all genuine and so on, and said, okay, you can have your things back. And there are pages and pages of it. Your National Archive makes it available. I have it here. In fairness to Dwight McKay, they were dealing with obviously hundreds upon hundreds or thousands of similar situations under great pressure just after the end of the war. And he allowed himself to be persuaded. And so Hildebrand Görlitz, the father of the man who has hoarded these things, was allowed to take his paintings back and carry on his life.
I'm talking with David Lewis, the co-chair of the Commission for Looted Art in Europe, and also Christoph Zuschlag, professor of art history at the University of Koblenz in Landau, Germany, about this incredible trove of 1,500 artworks that has recently turned up with an amazing history. Christoph, the Nazis waged a campaign against what they called degenerate art, and they even staged exhibitions of degenerate art.
Yeah.
But there's a fair amount of that so-called degenerate art in this trove of paintings. Why would they even have collected them if they considered them unworthy?
Yeah, that raises indeed a very important issue because Cornelius Gurlitt inherited all the works from his father, Hildebrand Gurlitt, and he was one of the four official art dealers who were commissioned by the Nazis to sell these artworks. It's exactly as you said. The Nazis confiscated in 1937 21,000 artworks. And some of them they showed in a traveling exhibition, Degenerate Art, which started in Munich in 1937. Others had to be sold. And there were four official dealers. And Hildebrand Gurlitt, the father of Cornelius, he was one of them. So that's why, obviously, a fair amount of these artworks, these 14 or 1,500 artworks, are from this action, Degenerate Art.
Now, what qualified something to be called degenerate? Was it simply that it was it wasn't totally realistic in that kind of waxy style that Nazi art had?
You know, degenerate is not a stylistic criteria or something like this. It's really a propaganda slogan. It really is a slogan which was projected against, you know, all the modern movements in German art in the first quarter of the 20th century.
Even artists who were members of the Nazi Party, like Emil Nolde, who suddenly found out that his work was being called degenerate. He thought he was a good Nazi.
Yeah, that's right. And he couldn't believe what happened there. I mean, this is really a very crude story. The German expressionists and Neue Sachlichkeit, constructivism, abstract art like Kandinsky and so on, they all were damned as degenerate art. It really was a political issue, and they used it as a propaganda vehicle to make a campaign against Jews and Bolshevists. They just claimed this art being Jewish and Bolshevist. So it really is a propaganda category.
Now, David, the New York Times pointed out today that France still has nearly 2,000 works in its museums that it knows were looted but cannot properly identify the ownership of. How difficult is it to figure out who owned what piece of art before the war? And is that going to be a major problem in finding who actually should be owning these 1,500 works?
Well, it obviously is a problem. If it was easy, then organizations such as ourselves would not have come into existence.
There are often multiple claims, aren't there?
Well, we deal in thousands of items over the years in any event. But this, as I said earlier, is unique because it is such a massive individual hoard. But the actual process of identification is no different to what we do all the time for various claimants day in, day out. So it is a time-consuming and difficult process. We have researchers in different places, in Europe, as well as in London. We are, by the way, non-profit making. Can I just mention that? We're not a commercial organization. The work is painstaking, but we hold records and we hold inventories, we hold auction catalogs, we hold lists that have been prepared by various authorities over the years, and it is just comparing one with the other and then comparing them again with applications by claimants, descendants of families who were murdered and so forth, or sometimes it was, you know, forced sales. Sales were at a nominal amount, but it can be done. But and what you need to do is to have the information.
Well, I'm assuming some of these were also stolen from museums, but what happens to artwork for which there are no claimants because they all died in the Holocaust?
This for me. So, I mean, look, sadly, that is the case, in which case all one can either... Well, there are two ways of dealing with that. Either the museum that holds them, we're talking here in public hands, will label it accordingly and make it very clear, as the French do. They call it, they give it information that these were works looted from Jewish families, but no survivors have been found. Or some organizations claim that items should be sold for the benefit of Holocaust survivors in general, and like that. These are issues of some argument. But, I mean, the real issue, if I may say, is that a proportion of this hoard will undoubtedly have been looted. A proportion came from museums and will stay in German public hands. A proportion... the so-called degenerate art and so forth. You know, the Nazis thought it, as Dr. Christoph said, it was propaganda. The art experts knew differently.
Well, they also could sell them,
sometimes.
Off. And Christoph, both the Nazis and the Soviets had special brigades to pillage artwork. Why was that done? Was it seen as a kind of a victor's trophy?
Well, maybe, yeah, mm-hmm.
So they took the stuff, and in many cases they wound up in the personal collections of leading figures in Nazi Germany and in the Soviet Union. And then when did the real stuff begin? When was it with the fall of the Soviet Union?
I'm not quite sure.
David?
Sorry, when did the real...
Well, when did the Nazi-looted art first become a major political issue with the fall of the Soviet Union?
Oh, a major political issue? Well, I mean, the sequence really is that after the Second War, a lot of things were given back to major collections where the inventories were printed and the Rothschilds and Rosenbergs and so forth. And then it gradually filtered out into nothing. No one paid any attention. People were trying to rebuild their lives. People were too busy worrying about the communism movement to worry about things like looted art. Gradually, as the years went by, it became an issue, basically from the fall of the Soviet Union, because when the Soviet Union fell, all sorts of records became available. They were the first into Berlin, of course. And the art world and descendants of claimants, by then another generation had emerged. Many first-generation survivors did not wish to be involved. It was too painful. Now the generation came. So gradually, from the early 90s, it's only 20 years ago, it became an issue, and that led, as we mentioned earlier, to the Washington Conference on looted art.
The Washington
Protocol.
Attended
by every major Western country.
Now, Christoph, we have less than 30 seconds, but I know you wanted to add something.
I just wanted to say that I believe it's really important that we examine the history of each artwork in this collection individually to find out about its history and who should belong it right today.
Uh-huh. So who does that research?
There have to be done a lot of research. That's no question. It will take years, and it's not possible for one person to do this research. It should be a team, or really, I would put it on the internet.
Now, I'm assuming that when the dust settles here and we see all 1,500 works, this is going to have a major impact not only on what we know about art, and especially modernist art, but also going to have a real impact on international art prices because some of these things are going to be sold. Mm-hmm. But we've run out of time, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. I thank both of you so much for being on our show. Christoph Zuschlag is a professor of art history at the University of Koblenz in Landau, Germany. David Lewis is the co-chair of the Commission for Looted Art in Europe. It's been a pleasure speaking with both of you.
My pleasure. Thank you.